from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. 30 years ago today, on October 17, 1989, at just after 5 p.m., a 6.9 magnitude earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, 10 miles from Santa Cruz, violently shook the Bay Area.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are going through an earthquake at this very moment, an earthquake that has been rattling this studio and shaking the lights.
The Loma Prieta earthquake killed 63 people, brought down a section of the Bay Bridge, and caused about $6 billion in damage throughout the area. We're going to look back at that day 30 years ago, and we want to hear from you. Where were you, and how did you experience the Loma Prieta? You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, and that's all next after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Today is the 30th anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake, which killed 63 people and caused about $6 billion damage in Northern California. The anniversary comes just days after the Bay Area was jolted by a 4.5 magnitude quake and Central California by a 4.7. Today, California's Office of Emergency Services is announcing the nation's first statewide earthquake warning system, which aims to give residents up to 10 seconds to prepare. And today we'll talk about what Loma Prieta taught us about earthquakes, and we want to hear from you. Where were you, and how did you experience the Loma Prieta earthquake? You can call us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. And you can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your thoughts, your questions, your comments to forum at kqed.org. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. We want to welcome first Steve Talbot, co-writer and co-producer of the NBC Bay Area News documentary Loma Prieta Earthquake 30 Years Later, which airs this Saturday, October 19th at 4 p.m. Steve, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Michael.
And congratulations. This is a real call back to memory, and it's also a very serious awakening about what we need to do about earthquakes. Good to have you with us. Also good to have Peggy Helwig with us, who's a seismologist and project manager with the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. Peggy Helwig, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you as well. And Steve Talbot, let me begin with you. I mean, you really bring it all back alive, not only really what happened to the Cypress Freeway, but also the catastrophe that it was. I mean, the deaths and the whole sense of what happened at the Bay Bridge and the Marina Fire and so forth. But there's also a good deal of hope in this film, and I just wanted to get that on the record, too. And I want to talk to you about that and highlight that. But first, people are going to be calling in and letting us know where they were. It's sort of like, where were you when Kennedy was assassinated, or where were you when 9/11 occurred? People do remember, and I remember driving down 19th Avenue, and it felt like all my tires were shot somehow, listening to the ball game. And the ball game plays a pretty central role in your film.
It does, Michael. To take people back, it was the World Series, and the Bay Area was completely abuzz because it was the first Bay Bridge series between the A's and the Giants. And that day was Game 3 of the World Series at Candlestick. The A's had won the first two games. There was a lot of excitement about what was going to happen. And at 5:04, shortly before the game was to start, suddenly that 6.9 earthquake rocked the stadium. And in a way, that World Series game prevented many deaths in the Bay Area because people were home in the Bay Area ready to watch the World Series on TV. And when the Cypress Freeway collapsed in Oakland, the double-decker freeway, normally at rush hour, there would have been hundreds or a thousand or more cars in that long, over a mile stretch of the freeway. But there weren't so many cars that day. Nevertheless, 42 people died at the Cypress Freeway, almost all of them instantly crushed.
And there were people at that Bay Bridge series who didn't want to leave. They felt, you know, let's get the game on here.
Yeah, that's one of the things. We spoke to Dave Stewart, the great pitcher from the A's, and to Will Clark, the star Giants first baseman of those days. And they were running wind sprints when the game started, and they knew this was pretty scary. And they saw the lights sway in the stadium, and there were some cracks at Candlestick. But fortunately, actually, aging Candlestick Park had been partially retrofitted thanks to Dianne Feinstein, actually, when she was mayor. there. And there wasn't that much damage at Candlestick. And a lot of people had felt earthquakes before in the Bay Area, and they knew this one had passed for the moment. And the fans started chanting, "Play ball."
Let's hear a cut.
The shaking lasted about 15 seconds, but Candlestick Park was still standing. After the initial shock, fans wanted the game to start.
One of the things I'll never forget is the crowd about 15 or 20 minutes later, not really understanding the extent of what had taken place, started chanting, "Play ball, play ball."
After everything sort of settled down, the fans started cheering like, "Yeah, welcome to San Francisco. You know, we're rocking now." Then, you know, on the flip side of things, a few minutes later, the radios were going pretty crazy. And
Bay Bridge did collapse.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, the marina was on fire. The Bay Bridge had collapsed. The Nimitz had collapsed. I mean, the realization came that, hey, look, this isn't about baseball no more. It's about life.
You know, the amazing thing about the film you've done, Steve, is how people rallied. And I'm thinking now, of course, of what happened in the Marina District, people running with hoses, but also a story you tell about a bookstore owner down in Santa Cruz, because Santa Cruz really suffered terribly in the Loma Prieta. It was almost in ruins. But there you see people really not only coming together, it's a bit of a cliche, but yet it's true that they really, in these kind of disasters and crises, manage to come together in extraordinary ways. And that's an important story in the individual stories that you tell. The other one that comes through for me, as after having seen your film, is how emotional people were when they just remembered what happened.
Absolutely. I got to say, I did this documentary with Christine Nee from Bay Area NBC, and they're great units. First time I've started working in commercial TV. I've always been a public TV person. And I was at KQED in 1989 when the earthquake struck. I got people out of the building, and we walked out into the parking lot, and a piece of the freeway fell onto a car, crushing the windshield right in front of us. And then all the traffic started to back up into the intersection because one section of the Bay Bridge, as you'll remember, collapsed. And there were rumors that the whole bridge had fallen, which, of course, was not true. But to get to that point about how people rallied, Art Agnos, the mayor at the time, most people would say, I certainly agree, did a fantastic job leading the city through that crisis. And he recalls it, and many other people that we spoke to do, and get very emotional about it. People from the marina, especially, where fires broke out because the gas lines exploded. They all talk about how everyone came together. There was no rioting in San Francisco. There was no looting. Crime went way down. People took over intersections where lights were all out to direct traffic. People rushed into buildings to help get them out, save them. So in a way, this happens sometimes in disasters, catastrophes, where people really rise to the occasion. And it's, in retrospect, you know, one guy from the marina was saying it, you know, made him tear up now to this day about how people really helped each other out.
You mentioned talking to Will Clark. I also talked to Dave Stewart, and he was tearing up. It was really a very emotional film in terms of the impact and memory. Here's another clip, actually, from your film. This is Mayor Art Agnos, whom you just mentioned, and Police Chief Frank Jordan talking about coordinating emergency response.
Mayor Art Agnos and former Police Chief Frank Jordan were rushed to a command center near City Hall.
I was handed this 6-inch loose leaf binder and said, here's the disaster plan. Well, it's kind of like walking onto an airplane and seeing the pilot walking with a manual say how to fly. I really had no time or capacity to deal with that, so I just went with my instincts.
Within a half an hour of that earthquake happening, myself and the Mayor Art Agnos were up in a helicopter taking a look at some of the damage. And the first place we went was around the Embarcadero Freeway. So our first order was to get everybody off of that freeway and nobody else on.
It's the first time I was scared because there was a complete blackout and fires all over the city. And of course, the major one was in the marina.
Another cut from Loma Prieta earthquake 30 years later. Steve Talbot, co-writer and co-producer of the NBC Bay Area News documentary, is with us. And so is Peggy Helwig, as I said earlier. She's a seismologist and project manager with the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. And Peggy Helwig, one of the things that the film brings out that I think is important for people to realize is that when there is a real connection here between that Loma Prieta earthquake and the earthquake of 06, 86% of San Francisco was gone after that quake, but both had to do essentially with ruptures on the San Andreas Fault. And I think that sort of brings us into the present. When we think about the San Andreas Fault, we also think about how much more serious in many ways the Hayward Fault is.
The Hayward Fault is definitely more serious. The San Andreas Fault doesn't run through San Francisco and highly populated areas. It's next to, it's not far, but the Hayward Fault is on the east side of the bay, of course, where I am, and not very far from me right now. All of the infrastructure that goes into San Francisco and, of course, the rest of the cities around here crosses the Hayward Fault. And so when the Hayward Fault earthquake happens, there's going to be a lot of chaos.
Well, the earthquake that we are not necessarily celebrating, but remembering 30 years later, the Loma Prieta, it didn't go all the way to the surface. It's what we call a blind earthquake. Is that right?
We could call it a blind earthquake. Yes, earthquakes rupture a big patch of the ground, and depending on how deep they are and how big they are, they may come through to the surface or not.
Lots of good things came out of this earthquake, though, not only in terms of a new ballpark and revived civic buildings and a lot of repair and renewal, but I'm also thinking about in your area of, well, earthquake warnings, for example, and now we have 30 years later, an announcement that we're going to have, earthquake warnings coming through to us on our cell phones and the like. Can you talk about that?
So in 1989, there was actually a manual, I'm going to call it, earthquake early warning system set up because the USGS put instruments down in the epicentral area and somebody radioed to the people who are working on the Cypress structure. There was another one, get out now, so that we didn't lose any more people in the Cypress structure due to aftershaking or shaking from aftershocks. And since 2006, we at Berkeley and our colleagues at Caltech and the USGS have been working to develop an earthquake early warning system. We have technology now that allows us to get high quality information about earthquakes from stations near those earthquakes just as the earthquake starts. And we're using that to produce earthquake information within seconds of the earthquake starting, which we couldn't do back then.
And we have all kinds of different sensors operating, too, and a whole different awareness of emergency responders. I'm not saying that everything is coming up roses here, but there have been some really dramatic and quantum changes.
So in terms of emergency response, my recollection is that what we now know of as the regular emergency response, where all of the organizations work together to respond, the incident command system that was developed based on the Loma Prieta earthquake experience and on the fires, the Oakland Hills fires that happened 2 years later.
And the San Andreas Fault still, I'm sorry to say, can break just about any time, really, can't it?
The exciting part of being a seismologist in California is that earthquakes can happen anywhere at any time. Yes.
On that note, let me get to some listeners here because I know many of you want to report what you went through 30 years ago when the Loma Prieta earthquake struck. And let's begin, Stephen, with you. You're on the air, Stephen. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I've been waiting 3 decades to tell a story. I was in an elevator when I was on that day. And it was something that I'll never forget. And I guess since it was an emotional experience, it's kind of branded into my brain. But in any case, I was on the 7th floor, I think, and I had just gotten on the elevator, and suddenly right after the door closed, suddenly the elevator started crashing against the sides of the walls, and I remember the cables above me going clang, 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 clang. And suddenly the lights went out, and I somehow found the telephone, you know, the emergency telephone. And I tried to call whoever was there to answer, and nobody would answer. I guess they had left the building already. And then the lights came back on. And since it was a hospital, I'm actually a registered nurse, and I was in the Army Nurse Corps at Fort Ord at the time. And anyway, the lights came back on, and the elevator delivered everybody to the bottom floor. And I couldn't tell where I was. We couldn't tell where we were. The signs on the ceiling were swaying back and forth. The doors were closed. There was dust in the air, and we found our way outside the building, and I told everybody to get away from the building, remembering all the movies and stuff like that.
Now, your memories are pretty vivid still, and I thank you for calling us and letting us know about that experience. Stephen actually joining us from Washington State. Here's Richard, who writes, I was at the World Series that day. I arrived at the ballpark and heard a loud roar. I thought the fans were stomping their feet in anticipation of the first pitch. I looked up and saw light stands crashing and chunks of concrete hit the ground. The cement under my feet went liquid and produced an unworldly wave. Players ran to the pitcher's mound, and all of a sudden the crowd cheered, play ball. I calmly handed over the food to my buddies and said, I am out of here. This was the big one. Let's hear from some more of you, and let me go next, if I may, to you, Danny. Thank you. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I was really young. I was 9 when the earthquake happened. I was a latchkey kid. I was home by myself. So there's lots of memories I have. But the biggest, most important one is I remember the story about the doctor that I went on to Cyprus and amputated the little boy's leg, saving his life. And I remember being 9 and feeling like that was like so incredible. That could have been me, my little brother. And that was just really awesome. It was one of the things that made me want to be a doctor. I did not become a doctor, but you know, at that time it was just such an awesome thing. And I always had this affinity for this doctor who had done this. Fast forward to about 6.5 years ago, my daughter was in a horrible accident and was sent to Children's by ambulance, and her head surgeon was Dr. James Bett, the same doctor who had performed that surgery on the Cyprus on his stomach for that little boy. And he's just, you know, amazing, very professional, very calm, and never came up the several weeks that my daughter was there in the hospital. We didn't talk about that.
Danny, I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Batts, because he is featured indeed in Steve Talbot's film. Steve, you want to talk about Dr. Batts?
I do. I'm very glad to hear that story. That's terrific. He was able to take care of your daughter. Dr. Batts is interviewed in the documentary, which incidentally anyone can watch online right now on the NBC Bay Area Revelations website. And as you mentioned, Michael, it's being repeated on NBC Bay Area on TV on Saturday. But Dr. Batts is an extraordinary man. He went out on that crushed Cypress freeway, crawled up on a fire ladder for the first time in his life, and found a car with two dead people in the car and a boy who was clinging to life but trapped. His legs were trapped under the collapsed car. And with aftershocks happening, Dr. Batts and another surgeon from Children's Hospital amputated that boy's leg and saved his life. And he is alive today and married and has a family. And Dr. Batts is an extraordinary guy who still does this kind of work and still works at Children's Hospital.
Yeah, he is an unbelievably impressive man in terms of not only that, but just his whole career. I'm going to go to you again, if I may, Peggy Helwig, because we just heard Steve Talbot mention aftershocks. Can you talk about the aftershocks, not only in conjunction with Loma Prieta, but what people ought to know now about aftershocks?
So whenever there's a big earthquake, there, even when there's a small earthquake, there are lots of little earthquakes that happen afterwards. If you imagine that as the big earthquake is you crumple a piece of paper and put it on the table, then the paper relaxes over time. And in the same way, the earth is shifted by the big earthquake, and there are a lot of places around it that have to relax over time. The bigger the earthquake, the more likely there are that there will be big aftershocks, and they can go on for months or even years. We're still experiencing aftershocks from the 2004 Sumatra earthquake, for example, in that area. So there, what we've learned more recently is the aftershocks don't have to be right where the earthquake was, which was what we thought back then. So they could be in a somewhat broader area around them. And then the other factor relating to aftershocks is occasionally, one case in 20 or so, an earthquake happens, and afterwards there's an even bigger earthquake. For example, the earthquake on Monday evening in Pleasant Hill, there was a small earthquake about 10 minutes before, which, since I live in Orinda, we felt. And then there's the main shock happened afterwards. So whenever there is a good-sized earthquake, we want people to be aware that there could be even a bigger earthquake afterwards, although the probability is not terribly high.
And again, we are remembering the Loma Prieta earthquake 30 years on and talking about temblors. And let's get another caller aboard, and that's you, Nancy. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was 4 years old when the earthquake happened and was also at home with my older brother. And I remember watching Silver Spoons on TV and ran out the door onto the street when it happened. But I actually had a question for the seismologist of these earthquakes that have been going on in the Bay Area this past week, the 4-point-somethings, do those in any way either decrease the risk or push off the timing of the quote-unquote big one coming, or is that not at all helpful in determining when and if a big one will happen?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Peggy. And that's Nancy. Let me go back to you, Peggy Helwig.
So the answer is that on average we get 10 earthquakes of, say, magnitude 4, and for each 10 earthquakes of magnitude 4, we get one of magnitude 5. But in fact, to make up the energy that is released by a magnitude 5, we would need 30 earthquakes of magnitude 4. So they do release some strain, but not nearly enough to prevent the big ones from happening.
And a question from a listener named Allie to you, Peggy Helwig. She says, can you explain the differences between the shake alert system and the commercially available early warning lab system to both assist residents in the Bay Area?
So the answer is the shake alert system is the government-run system, and it's run by UC Berkeley and Caltech also, to detect earthquakes quickly and produce the information that an earthquake is happening. And most of the other systems that are currently being tested are receiving that alert information and passing it on to users.
In real time, right?
As fast as possible, because not as fast as possible doesn't make it any useful. So Early Warning Labs has an app. UC Berkeley has been developing an app, too, that I got an earthquake alert for the magnitude 4.5 that happened in Pleasant Hill because I'm a test user. And I felt the shaking, and then I got the alert because I was so close to the earthquake that the time it took to produce the alert was longer than the time it took to get the waves to me. So in any of these apps or ways to pass the information along, you may get the alert before or during or after the shaking at your location.
Again, Peggy Helwig with us is a seismologist and project manager of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. We also have Steve Talbot, co-writer and co-producer of the NBC Bay Area news documentary Loma Prieta Earthquake 30 Years Later, which again airs this Saturday, October 19th at 4 p.m. And we'll find out what more of you experienced then and take your questions and comments. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about earthquakes, but really specifically focusing on Loma Prieta, which occurred 30 years ago today. And a reminder that at 10:17 today, millions of people worldwide are going to practice how to drop cover and hold on during the great shakeout earthquake drills. More information can be found on that at shakeout.org. And we're talking with Steve Talbot and Peggy Helwig and taking your calls and memories, narratives from you about where you were during the earthquake and any questions you have about earthquakes in general. Here's Bonnie who writes, I was on First Street on-ramp to the Bay Bridge. It was a long night. Ramin writes, I was at the office rolling around in my chair while a colleague held up his fish tank to keep from toppling over. And Andrea says, I was at UC Davis as a student living in Hungary for a semester with no cell phones, and being in a communist country, accurate information was limited. We heard the entire Bay Bridge had collapsed. We finally got information through Reuters wires, and our host university let us make calls home. A tweet from a listener says, I was living in Brazil at the time and was 8 years of age when Loma Prieta happened. My family had just subscribed to Time magazine, and the first issue we received had Loma Prieta's main article with a picture of the cracked Bay Air Bridge on the cover. Martha writes, I was at work at the now-demolished Sutter Memorial Hospital in Sacramento. My two coworkers and I each thought I have a stomach ache without realizing it was affecting anyone else. It was only when I went to ask one of the radiologists a question that I found out it was an earthquake. A doctor said he thought he was having a heart attack until he looked up and saw one of the cabinet doors swinging. The images of the collapsed freeway and fractured Bay Bridge were terrifying. Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Asha. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, you're on the air.
Sorry, I had my phone on mute. So I was young as well. I was six, and I was at home, and I was watching cartoons, and I remember things started shaking, so I ran outside. My grandfather was outside. I ran outside in hysterics, and he, you know, was using a jackhammer to tear up the front concrete in front of the house. And so when I came out running, he had no clue what I was talking about. And just kind of looked at me like, what's the matter with you? Because he didn't feel anything because he was using a jackhammer at the time. My mom worked downtown Oakland at Emporium Capwell's, which suffered a lot of damage and was closed for years after that. And she has a woman who will to this day tell you that my mom saved her life because she froze and wouldn't move. And things are starting to come down in the store and it's starting to shake. And then my father worked in San Francisco at the time and was getting ready to cross the bridge. And a client called him back to the office. Otherwise, he would have been on the bridge at the time that it suffered the damage. So there was so much going on, and it's one of my most vivid memories as a six-year-old.
And thank you so much for letting us know those vivid memories, Asha. Good to hear from you this morning. Let me hear from another caller, and we go to you. Jake, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I live in Oakland, and I work in earthquake engineering, and I hear a lot of my, you know, neighbors and friends in the East Bay talk about how, oh, well, my, you know, house or building survived Loma Prieta, so, you know, I'm not too worried. I should be fine. And I try to remind them all the time that earthquakes, you know, the severity of the shaking that you feel has a large proximity to the, you know, your own proximity to the source. So if you are, you know, thinking that Loma Prieta was the big one, you need to rethink it because that was Santa Cruz's big one. If we had the Hayward fault rupture in, say, Oakland or Hayward, things could be significantly more catastrophic for the East Bay. And people seem to think that what we saw back in 89 is as bad as it can get. But that was, you know, 80, 100 miles away. We really need to be thinking about, you know, how it could affect us if it was underneath our own city.
The big one, I'm afraid to say, Peggy Helwig, is still ahead of us somewhere down the line.
There will be a big one, yes. And what we've experienced in the last 30 years was not the big one.
Unfortunately, Steve Talbot, there are some, you know, really heartwarming and wonderful stories that come through in your film, but there are also some funny ones. I want to mention that because I thought, for example, the story about how Bob Lurie reacted when Mayor Agnos, then Art Agnos, said to him, well, we got to move this Bay Area World Series down to San Diego. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. Well, you know, there were aftershocks and bodies were still being recovered from the collapsed Cypress Freeway. And Bob Faye Vincent, the baseball commissioner, wanted to start the series again, you know. And he went to Art Agnos, the mayor of San Francisco at the time, and said, come on, let's play ball. And Agnos said, what are you, crazy? You know, people are still suffering. We're not going to start the World Series again until we're through the worst of this tragedy. And Lurie's and Vincent said, okay, well, I guess we got to move the series to San Diego. And Bob Lurie, who owned the Giants, jumped up, according to Agnos, and screaming over my goddamn dead body, you'll do that.
And tell, if you would, the story about Joe DiMaggio and Agnos.
Yeah, Joe DiMaggio, baseball legend, is a San Francisco person. He lived in the Marina. He had a place in the Marina. And the Marina was one of the hardest hit areas in San Francisco because it's built on landfill. Landfill, incidentally, from the 1906 earthquake, which really was a big one. And that area shook like jello. And buildings collapsed, apartments collapsed, gas mains broke. And one of the residents down there, this Stephen Bradassane, a dentist, he is an amazing guy. And he says, you know, unless that fireboat, the Phoenix, had been there, because water mains were broken. It was pumping seawater. They managed to hook up a hose to it, neighborhood volunteers along with the fire department. And because of that fireboat and those volunteers, they were able to put out these fires. They ran it for like 20 hours straight after the earthquake. And that is what really saved the whole marina from going up in flames. So that was the worst spot in San Francisco.
And Peggy Helwig, if I can go back to what we have maybe learned from Loma Prieta, I mean, it taught us a lot about how it's not just the proximity to the epicenter, but it's also what the ground is that determines destruction.
Yeah, so I think seismologists knew that before, and geotechnical engineers, that if you're on hard rock, then the ground is not going to shake nearly as hard as it is if it's very soft, very filled, not very compacted. But a problem with the not compacted, the water-saturated soils that we have all the way around the bay is that they can also liquefy. That we saw evidence of that in the toll plaza area for the Bay Bridge. And there's the rupture, of course, which we didn't have surface rupture in Loma Prieta, but in 1906 there was certainly surface rupture. There are landslides that can be caused by the earthquake. There's the shaking. So there's a broad range of hazards that are associated with earthquakes. And, of course, in Loma Prieta there was no tsunami. In 1906 there was a very small tsunami because that's not the kind of earthquake it was, but tsunamis are also an earthquake-related hazard, particularly for the North Bay and up the coast, and also particularly for people on the coast, even if it's a more distant earthquake.
Again, Peggy Helwig is a seismologist, and she's project manager of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. Here's Anne, who tweets to us, "I was six playing Barbies with my sister in the living room at our house in Scotts Valley. We heard a low roar, then felt shaking and ran outside. We didn't understand what was going on until my mom ran out and told us. Good thing we ran, because the TV fell over right where we were playing." And Neil writes, "People did come together, folks directing traffic and coming out to the streets and being friendly and human. My boyfriend and I didn't know our neighbors, but after that we were all close friends. I remember thinking that liquid and solid are relative terms." Let's go to another caller here. That's William. Good morning.
Hi. I was a graduate student and had gotten out of school early that day and was going for a bike ride and was riding around Lake Merced and pulled on up to a stop sign. When I was thrown probably 5 or 6 feet up in the air and landed kind of tangled in my bike, I looked up and there was a pickup truck behind me, which I thought had hit me and was going to run me over. And I was about to yell at him. And the crazy thing was I saw a big wave coming down the road behind us, flipping cars up in the air as it came, like a wave in a jump rope. And it threw the pickup truck in the air and threw me up in the air again. It was the most remarkable thing I've ever seen.
Remarkable, but terrifying from the way you describe it.
Well, I certainly remember it pretty vividly.
Yeah.
I think I was a little too shocked to be scared. There was a pedestrian standing on the side of the road, I think, who was more scared than me.
Yeah. Peggy, how can you sort of describe for us what might have happened in the way William has described it here?
Yeah, so
concrete buckles, right? That's part of it, I think.
Well, yes and no, I guess. The problem is that we imagine earthquakes as being relatively small shakers, and most of the ones we measure are at a great distance from our seismometers, and so we have small movements there. But in 1906, the ground shifted by about 18 feet, and in the Loma Prieta, the ground underground shifted by about 6 feet. So that movement decays, of course, as you get farther and farther away, and in regions like the Bay Area for the Loma Prieta earthquake, the ground movement, the waves that are going can still be up to several inches, maybe even tens of inches high. And if you happen to be on one of those waves, then it may throw you up in the air.
It's a hell of a way to surf, huh? Let me get another caller in here. We go to Jack. I'm sorry, what?
They're very fast waves. I don't think we could surf them.
No, I'm joking. Let me get Jacqueline on here. Jacqueline, go ahead.
Hi, Michael. This is Jacqueline here. I'm in Marin, and my husband and I, Kenneth, worked in San Francisco. I was on Nob Hill with my one-year-old celebrating his birthday with another child. And just like Peggy was saying, it's a wave. It's, and the building felt like it was jello. The children were enchanted. They thought it was like a roller coaster ride. They were having fun. But we went outside. My husband Kenneth made his way from the south of Market to us. And I just wanted to remark, like Steve was saying and other callers have said, that this was possibly an evolutionary moment in humankind, and especially in the Bay Area, where despite all that adrenaline and fear, our propensity toward kindness and mindfulness was very evident. You know, people were directing at stop signs. People were being courteous of each other. And there was an immense feeling of community created and continues to be so. So thanks for hearing my comment. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for the comment. And again, I go back to the ball game, Steve, because there's a lot of that in your film. I was struck, in fact, when Al Michaels, who was a play-by-play guy, still is, as far as I know, was talking about, and you hear all these different stories, and you realize people had such great variety of sensations of what they thought they were experiencing because it comes so suddenly and so unexpectedly and unpredictably. But Al Michaels thought there were kids banging with their bats. I mean, it's sort of funny in a way, but again, it just shows the wide range and disparity of what people experience.
Yes, and let's remember that the effects of the earthquake in 30 years ago in San Francisco were vastly unequal. So if you were on the Cypress Freeway, it was a death trap. If you were in the marina, it was a nightmare. It was very scary in other places. The earlier caller who talked about being stuck in an elevator, people have, you know, some very terrifying experiences that they went through. But there were other places in the city that were, once this huge jolt went through, and it was a double jolt, it lasted between 15 and 17 seconds. I'm a Californian. I've been here my whole life in Los Angeles and the Bay Area, and I'd never felt an earthquake that strong. And so it got your attention. But there were places that were totally unaffected because once the shaking stopped. So that's what happens with earthquakes. I'm really glad you're doing this show, Michael, and I hope people watch this documentary more, because what we're really trying to remember, if for most people, many, many people in the Bay Area, maybe a majority now, were not here 30 years ago or were not alive and don't have any memory of what this is like. But as Peggy keeps saying, at some point, the big one is going to come. And as other callers have mentioned, we're all going to have to help each other out to make it through it.
You also say early on in the film, or I should say my friend Peter Coyote says, because he voices it, that the film wants to show us what we can expect and how we might survive. And talk to that for a moment, if you could, Steve.
Well, look, we need as much warning as we can possibly get from the shake alert system, even if it's only 10, 20 seconds. There's some things you can do, as the USGS geologist Carol Prentice says in the show. Let's remember, we have a safer bridge now, because the bridge, at great cost and over a lot of time, the Bay Bridge, the section of it in the eastern span, was completely rebuilt, and it's a safer, better bridge. And even though there's massive construction that drives me crazy all throughout San Francisco now, these are better engineered buildings, and other buildings have been retrofit. And the Embarcadero Freeway, which is a disaster waiting to happen, was torn down thanks to Art Agnos and others, although it cost him politically because he lost votes in Chinatown. But we now have a beautiful waterfront that's been opened up as well. So the city in many ways is stronger and better, the whole Bay Area, because of the Loma Prieta earthquake. But as Art Agnos says later, you know, a disaster, we call a disaster because it's a disaster. There's some things you absolutely can't control. And when it happens, the more neighborhood training we have, the more first responders, medical personnel willing to risk their lives, geologists helping as much as possible, we really do need each other to get through, you know, God forbid, really the big one.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that 63 people died and that the marina was burned to a great degree, and Santa Cruz likewise, you agree with John King? I read an article of his that appeared soon after, about a decade after, and he was talking about how it really changed San Francisco for the better, ultimately.
I think so. And Art Agno says, you know, the getting rid of the Embarcadero Freeway, which was a great ride if you drove on it, but cut off the whole city from the waterfront. And he says it was like removing a scar from your face. And it opened up the whole bay, and the ferry building was restored, and the Giants baseball stadium was built, and there's an economic revival along that waterfront. So, yeah, in many ways, the city is better because of the Loma Prieta earthquake. Another place that is Santa Cruz that you mentioned before, Michael. Santa Cruz, the mall, the beautiful mall there, and I love Santa Cruz. Half my family went to college there. You know, they were brick, unreinforced buildings. And downtown Santa Cruz, which was very close to the epicenter of the earthquake, it was a disaster area. Fortunately, there weren't many people killed, but that city took years and years to recover. It's now fantastic along the mall. And the centerpiece of all that is the Santa Cruz Bookshop, which has fully restored and bigger and better than ever.
And that's quite a story in the film. Also, since I mentioned John King, he points out new layers to existing neighborhoods and stronger infrastructure, but he also talks about renewal of civic and cultural landmarks. And I'm going to read a comment from Aaron, who says, I was 10. My brother and I were atop our cedar swing set in Richmond. I recall my dad standing in the doorway of our house beckoning us to join him, but even to my young man, it seemed unwise to go under a structure. We ran out to the middle of the lawn and waited. Let me go back to you, if I may, Peggy Helwig. It's never a bad idea to remind people about what they're supposed to do during an earthquake. You know, stand in a doorway, get under a table, and so forth. Your wisdom here, please.
So the best science for earthquakes here in a place where buildings are relatively safe and the shaking is going to come very quickly is to drop cover and hold on and leave the building after the shaking stops when you've made sure that it's safe. The two people who were killed in the San Simeon earthquake in 2003 both ran out of the building and were killed by falling awnings, essentially concrete awnings from the buildings there. And there were a lot of pictures after Loma Prieta and after 1906, of course, where unreinforced masonry building fronts had collapsed onto cars and wagons and stuff like that. So our best science right now says shelter under something sturdy that can protect you. If you can't do that, protect your head and neck. And don't try and run out because, as the bicyclist told us earlier on, sometimes it's hard to walk when the shaking is very strong.
Another caller joining us, Jeremy. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling from Capitola. I just first want to take a little exception with the second-to-last commenter saying that Santa Cruz was totally better now, because we did kind of end an era there where the Cooper House is not there, and it was kind of an end of an era as far as the downtown, the whole vibe of the city changed. And, yeah, it did take a lot of years to rebuild and whatnot, but it's never been the same that it has been. So it is a lot better now, but it kind of, you know, it ended that era. But I was in sixth grade when the earthquake hit, and I was riding my bike home from school in Scotts Valley, and I was supposed to be home at 5, and obviously it happened at 5:04, so I was a little late. The thing that struck me was I heard it coming before I felt anything. And my first thought was, why is everyone's houses creaking? I heard this creaking wood sound, creaking nails, kind of like sound like everyone's fences was shaking and creaking way before I even heard or felt anything. And after that, it kind of threw me off my bike. And as someone mentioned before, incredible, I saw four-foot waves of concrete. I was up in the air, then I was down. I was up in the air, I was down. During the whole thing, the asphalt that I was on was literally waving up and down 4 or 5 feet at a time. And this gentleman ran out of his house in his underwear with a blanket. He obviously was a shift worker, you know, sleeping during the day or something. And he covered me up with the blanket, and he said, "Whoa, man, that was a big one." And I wasn't frightened at all by him being there at all. It was kind of cool that he had ran out and covered me up and kind of said, like, "Dude, that was a big one. You know, like, where do you live?" You know, and he was freaked out, too. but it was a tribute.
But kind enough to bring a blanket for you. That's a touching story, and I thank you for sharing that story, Jeremy. Appreciate hearing from you this morning. I'm going to read some memories from David, who says, the worst part of San Francisco was a small alley off Townsend Street where several people were crushed in a car while waiting at a stop sign. I know, because I dug two of them out. No one talks about those poor souls because at the time that part of town was not nearly as cool and desirable as it is today, nor the marina. We'll go to more calls. And let's go next to you, Dan. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Good morning. I remember at the time there was lots of talk about what we now call first responders not being in the city in Oakland because the price of the city excluded them from being homeowners or even residents in the city. I was wondering what, if any, progress has been made in making the cities more affordable so that as we bind together, when the big one comes, we actually have professionals to guide us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. It may be a little out of the bailiwick of both Steve Talbot and Peggy Helwig, but certainly your brother David writes a lot about this, Steve. We have a plug for his work here. Any response?
Yeah, actually, Dr. Bradasani from the marina, the man I mentioned before, the dentist who was there, who tells a very dramatic story of what happened battling the fires in the marina, you know, he says, hey, the marina, that's where the cops and the fire department lived in this city back then.
Back then, yeah.
Back then, not now with the insane prices, housing and rental fee prices. So, yeah, they're gone. And I'll tell you one other thing that's gone is the military. 30 years ago, the military had a major presence in the Bay Area, including in the Presidio.
Yeah.
And the Presidio soldiers came out and ringed off the marina at the time to, you know, prevent people from coming in who shouldn't have been there. In the end, as they say, there was no crime, there was no looting, everything was totally safe in that respect. But the military provided helicopters and, you know, there was no helicopter for the city. Frank Jordan, who spoke earlier, the police chief at the time, in Art Agnos, went up in an FBI helicopter.
Let me thank the caller and read a comment that's coming in right now from a listener who writes, I had just gotten home 5 minutes before to Berkeley from San Francisco. It was my birthday. Today I'm 66. Happy birthday, listener. I was at the D. Young with my sister Bonnie. We had just gone on the simulated earthquake ride. And here's another caller, and that's Faye. Faye, good morning.
Hi there. Well, I was actually a former coworker with Steve at KQED, and in 89, that was my first big job as a camera person out at Candlestick for the Japanese television. And when I, you know, the wave came of the earthquake, everybody laughed nervously, and then it was like, okay, play ball. But then somebody yelled, the Bay Bridge collapsed on itself. And I said, Nick, get out. And when I went, they said, yeah, go look at the French feed, because there was French camera people or a French broadcasting situation going on in another press box. And I looked and I saw the video and I went, oh, my gosh. And, you know, I was there till 3:30 in the morning. And so was Al Michaels. And we had to turn into a news crew on the spot, live to Tokyo. And when I drove home, I couldn't go along the freeway. They said, go along 3rd Street. And I lived in Russian Hill at the time. And I thought, okay, everything's fine. The lights are on. But when I drove up Larkin Street, it was like a war zone. There was a big fissure in the middle of the street, rubble and glass all over, pitch black. So I had to drive home with the highlights going and the hazards flashing, and there was no one out. It was scary. And, yeah, the next day I was driving back to Candlestick, and all the lights are out along Van Ness, everything. It was a mess.
It was spooky. I remember that as well, with all the lights out. And, Faye, thank you for that. I'm also, again, thinking about some of the good things that came out of Loma Prieta. And, Steve Talbot, really NERT was formed because of Loma Prieta, wasn't it?
It was. That's the Neighborhood Emergency Response Team group, NERT. And as this Dr. Bradasani says, you know, really this kind of training, we say 30,000 people have been trained in the city of San Francisco now to be emergency responders, to do basic health treatment. And he says it should be taught in schools.
Not a bad idea. Would certainly welcome that. And here's another, welcoming another comment from a caller named Patrice who writes, when the quake hit, I was trying to sneak into the World Series. Some guy went running through the crowd yelling, the Bay Bridge collapsed into the bay. And my immediate thought was, where's Jen, my then girlfriend? That she was my first thought, and this moment was interesting to me. 1 week later, I proposed, and we'll be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary next June. Here's another caller. Heather, join us. You're on the air.
Well, hi there. I just wanted to share something that was maybe a little bit on the comical side. I was playing volleyball at West Valley Junior College down in the San Jose area, and we had just started practice when the ground started to shake. All the lights went out. There were no windows in this gym, so we started making a run for the door. And as we're kind of trying to run to the door, the floor felt like a fun house at an amusement park, sliding back and forth. We could hear things falling from the ceiling, so we were figuring the ceiling was caving in, everything was falling. When the lights came back on, what we actually found out was every badminton that had been stuck in the ceiling, every volleyball, every basketball, everything had been shooken loose, and the whole ground of the gym floor was covered with all different types of sporting equipment. So that was kind of our comical side that we had, with a bunch of leftover badmintons, volleyballs, and soccer balls.
Well, thank you for that comic memory. It's good in the wake of all the really troubling memories that continue to endure. But it's been an important hour, and an important hour for listeners to reflect on Loma Prieta. You can continue this discussion online. We encourage you to do that at kqed.org/forum. Thank you, Steve Talbot. Congratulations again on the film.
Thanks, Michael.
And thank you, Peggy Helwig. Good to have you with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And again, remind you, this is Thursday, and we want to tell you who's behind the scenes on Thursdays. KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Ariana Prale, and we get support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.